CBS in the World. I'm John Batchelor. Infrastructure, the word itself, easy to imagine a bridge, a very large bridge like the Golden Gate Bridge. Infrastructure. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing about infrastructure. And over the years, the professor has guided me to understand that there's a deal to discover in the Roman Empire, particularly because the professor teaches Roman law to young law students. I am not. What I could do was go read about the Roman Empire in English. And that brought me to the city of Londinium 2,000 years ago, where infrastructure was critical for bridging the Thames, for the marshes that were south of the Thames that needed to constantly being drained or deal with the roads being washed away in season. And then there was the amphitheater that had to be maintained, perhaps with donations to the various gods, perhaps with donations to the Emperor Augustus, the Emperor Vespasian. You understand, there were different methods of raising money. However, there were at least one, perhaps two large buildings that look like cathedrals to us. The cathedral model is based upon the Roman Basilica. These were a combination of government offices and private enterprise, all mixed up, roofed from the weather, and then outside were the narrow streets where people plied their trade. All of this is 2,000 years ago. Who maintained that archaeology today? Who built all this? Who made sure it didn't fall into disuse or ruin when a rascal like Boudicca raided in and killed everybody in 60 AD? So we come to the word infrastructure. Professor, a very good evening to you. Forgive me for my prelude, but you triggered this. And so I ask you now, the Roman understanding of infrastructure was the emperor, the senate, the local legate was responsible for fixing this or draining that or building this. 2,000 years later, that presumption has gone by the board. You as a classical liberal, where is the assumption that Rome must do this? Good evening to you.
Yeah, hi. Well, I mean, let's start back with the Roman period. If you go back to book two of Justinian, he lists a whole variety of things that are called common properties. And they have very, very different features to them. There's things like rivers and beach shores in the air, which are open to everybody and require no infrastructure investment at all. But then you start getting other things like roads and getting various kinds of key government buildings and so forth, and bridges and tunnels and aqueducts, and these require immense investment. So the first question you ask yourself, is there any private institution out there which can do this if given a free rein? And the answer is no. Under Roman law, there was no really systematic notion of corporations with limited liability, which would allow a private party to aggregate large amounts of money. Indeed, the currency flows were probably sufficiently small that you couldn't even find enough money to aggregate, so this is going to have to be done by some other means. And the only other means is the state. What the state will do, of course, is then try to figure out how to do this cheaply. And in Rome, there was another resource known as slaves who could put to work on these kinds of things without worrying about their various kinds of demands, except in the most rudimentary sense. And what you did is you put these things together. Private enterprise, and the Romans were very good at that, were essentially small business trading companies of one kind or another. They couldn't possibly scale up to do the sorts of things. And so what happens is Roman infrastructure essentially is from beginning to end a huge public event. When you start getting to modern times, the key difference is capital markets are now enormously efficient, and you could find ways through limited liability corporations of one kind or another to put together huge sums of money to develop this kind of stuff. And then the question is, how does that private money interact with the state? It's not a very easy question to answer, because usually the creation of infrastructure requires that you acquire some kind of property which you don't own to begin with. And so if you're doing a pipeline, you have to be able to get easements over 1,000 miles. And that's going to require, in many cases, some degree of coercion. The coercion may not be used in particular case, but the threat of confiscation has to be there in order to induce a transaction whereby property is sold. But if, in fact, you can start getting these private parties together to build this stuff, the theory is that they will be able to do so at a lower cost with greater efficiencies than will the government, which is going to be racked with various kinds of political intrigue. But this doesn't end the problem either, because the moment you create this sort of infrastructure, the question is this going to be some kind of a monopoly? That is, there's only going to be one road that goes from London to Reading. There's only going to be one railroad that goes from London to Oxford or whatever. And if so, the state then comes in to regulate the kinds of rates that private parties can charge. And if the state decides to build it, generally speaking, there's going to be a long tradition which says that it cannot gouge its many citizens but has to observe the same kinds of limitations. So what we see starting in the 19th century, say, in America, is large amounts of private investments in things like the railroads, and it's a peculiar system. What happens is there's a government subsidy that's involved. They're given the land, and then they're given land beside the railroad tracks, which they could use for development as compensation for the heavy labor they're going to do. The rest of the land is retained by the federal government, is then sold off to private parties and so on, and then they're made, depending upon the nature of the railroad line, be some kind of restrictions on the rates that they could charge for passengers and for freight. So we develop a very much more complicated kind of system. And even going forward today, you have exactly that same situation. Nobody thinks that the system is wrong in principle. What people are aware of is that it is subject to subversion and abuse, particularly when government comes in. So I can give you but one illustration. If you're going to have a federal funding of infrastructure throughout the United States, you could play old pork barrel politics like Chuck Schumer and say, hey, a lot more of the money is going to come to New York State from other places. So we're going to put in, say, $1 billion, and we're going to get out $5 billion of this money, which means that some other places are going to be short $4 billion. So the infrastructure game, although it's the correct model, doesn't stop the abuse game unless you have some kind of constitutional protections against that, which, in fact, are fairly difficult to be put into place and fairly difficult to maintain. It was done for many years before 1937, but those protections have sort of disappeared. And we now have a situation where infrastructure is necessary on the one hand and subject to political vulnerabilities on the other.
I want to stay with Londinium for a moment. When the Thames would flood, which was regularly, but in any event, there would be businesses along the riverfront that would be underwater or wrecked or destroyed. The road would be washed out. The bridge would have to be rebuilt. The presumption 2,000 years ago was that Rome must do this. The local authorities must do this. The governor of a Roman Britain must do this. That was the presumption. Nobody doubted it. Here, 2,000 years later, it is striking to me, Richard, that the presumption is still in the land of the free, the United States of America. It's also heavily in Europe where we inherited it. So there seems to be a built-in default to the state. And capital markets are not seen as a remedy. In fact, often capital markets are regarded as what you'd have to say, brother-in-law markets, right? That's how the Romans thought of them. They would always be handing out gifts to their families or their larger intermarried families. That's how Roman elite maintained themselves. I believe that prejudice is still in place, correct, Professor?
But there's some of it, yes, and some of it, no. You have to go through different kinds of infrastructure, for example. So Roman infrastructure included, or common property, sort of very large public buildings like amphitheaters and arenas. And, you know, you start talking about stadiums for football, basketball, baseball, and the like, is that kind of situation. There, it's perfectly clear you could run a private system so long as you could overcome the land assembly problem, either by having a government engage in condemnation efforts on the one hand, or having an elaborate set of buyouts by private parties that give it to you. What typically happens, however, is that the moment these stadium deals start to get going, somebody's going to throw a huge subsidy on the plate, which will distort them. So we've had studies done at the University of Chicago where virtually every single stadium deal that is put together for public support turns out to be essentially a huge transfer. So when Soldier Field was basically redone with public monies in 2002, where they put the giant toilet bowl on top of a world-class monument, the McCaskies came out with about $300 million worth of profit, and general taxes had to pay for this at the tune of about $600 million. So you could see what the particular loss is. There were other cases where it wasn't happening. So, for example, Walter O'Malley, when he wanted to build a new station for the new stadium for the Dodgers, he was prepared to fund the entire thing with private money. But Robert Moses, who was the czar at that time, didn't want to do this where the Nets now are, in a central location in Brooklyn. He wanted to have them as the Queens Mets out where Shea Stadium is today. And the whole deal broke down because you couldn't get the public and private money together. The Dodgers went out to Los Angeles. The Giants went out to San Francisco. And the rest is history. So one of the things that you discover is if you're trying to get rid of public resources and privatize, or if you're trying to get public investment in private activities, the politics of this thing can overwhelm everything. And the situation is not made any easier if what you try to do is to expand the term infrastructure so that it covers any kind of long-term investment, whether or not it's like a road or a highway that links something together. But do it for anything, human infrastructure, then in effect what happens is you have a recipe for the state funding everything, and infrastructure, instead of being an exception, becomes the opening way in which there's social control or the means of protection or socialism.
Let's get into our time machine and go forward from Londinium 90 AD to 2021 with the word infrastructure. Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow for the Hoover Institution. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago and the NYU. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.